Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I, your weekly roundup of the top personal finance, consumer and business stories that editor Simon Lamb and his team have been covering on their award-winning website. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside Simon and I today is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And in today's show, it's all in the mind. We look at what money worries are keeping us up at night and why it's not you, but evolution to blame for your poor financial decision-making. But thankfully, the team have some useful tips to help you beat your own brain. Also today, how Britain has sunk to the bottom of a global retirement league table. NS&I launches not one, but four new savings accounts with one, a near market-leading 2.2% rate, but there's a catch. And as stock markets continue to soar to record highs this year, Simon urges us to have an investing plan B. All that and plenty more coming up. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, making saving that little bit more exciting.
So spending too much, not saving enough for retirement, procrastinating, making stupid choices with your money. Sound familiar? Well, it's not you. Sort of. It's your brain. According to experts, we're wired to pay off the wrong debts and sell shares at the worst time because our instincts just aren't designed to handle complex financial decisions. Brilliant, as it's not like we have many to make. What makes it worse, though, is companies are well-versed in how to take advantage of our human foibles. So it's time to take back control and to beat those mind tricks that are leaving us poorer because apparently it is possible. A very warm welcome to you both. So what is this research all about, Lee?
Actually, I'll start with a quote here from a reader in Behavioural Economics who's quoting the story at University College London. It says, "We are making decisions all day, every day, and 99% of them aren't crazy. But there are some systematic errors we make because of our nature and the environment we evolved in." Now, this is my favourite bit. "We didn't evolve with laptops and spreadsheets, but our decisions make sense for, say, the jungle where we did evolve." So we're going back to real sort of fundamental basics here, you know, millennia ago, how our brains are wired. And what he's saying here is actually, it's very complex. A lot of financial decisions that you make throughout your life, whether it be thinking about retirement, whether it's about investing, whether it's clearing debts, and our brains are sort of hardwired to not really quite get it. And we make all of these sort of common mistakes, and it's not just a few people, it's a lot of people. So an example here that they've got, imagine that you borrow £100, over the 12 months you repay the loan by paying £10 a month, a total of £120 over the year. What rate of interest did you pay? So the majority of people will say automatically 20% interest, which you think, oh, yeah.
Isn't that just we're bad at maths?
That sounds right.
Well, it's what's evolution got to do with that?
There's a little bit of that, but it's just how your brain processes information. So actually, it is a good thing to think about when you're looking at something like interest on a credit card, and if you're actually calculating it right. And a lot of people just go, oh, bleh, no, I don't want to know. But you should. We've said in the show all year about rising credit card debt. If you can't understand the fundamental basis of paying it back, then it's probably something that you shouldn't be getting out. But the actual interest rate on that answer is closer to 40%.
Yeah.
There's loads of little examples like that in here. There's that common thing about ditching your coffee. It's £900 over a year, actually, for £2.50 coffee. And you think, well, okay, that's all well and good, but you want your coffee.
Yeah.
Right? So
short-term gain.
Short-term gain. So this is exactly what it's saying. People want their caffeine fix because it's comforting. It does things to our brains where we go, oh, you know, this is what I need. Like this short-term caffeine fix, who cares about this long-term, you know, £900? But what the research is saying is that because it's so vague, saying you're going to save £2.50 a day, and people just go, well, I don't really know what that means. Who cares? I just want my coffee. But if you actually invest it, if you ditched it for a year, you could have an extra £6,000 at retirement if that £900 that you saved over a year went into a pension that grew at 5%, which is a pretty, you know, average amount for the next 40 years. Now, you start thinking of it like that, going, well, hold on, if I ditch my coffee, make it at home and whatnot, and I can save £900, but actually that turns into £6,000 in my retirement, people might start thinking about it a bit differently. And this is what this whole article, this whole feature is all about. Little nifty tricks where we're going, okay, this whole coffee chat has been around for years and people are just probably quite fed up with it. But if you think about it in that sort of more longer term, stick this in your pension, wow, hold on a minute, that's £6,500 more for ditching a coffee a day. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I'm thinking about that, Lee. I'm not going to ditch a coffee a day, though. I'll be totally honest with you. So even if I do think about it, doesn't mean I'm going to change much. And don't think, Simon Labber, you've got off lightly on this one as he holds up his coffee cup, because someone was late to the studio today because they had to go and pick up their coffee. But what Lee's saying when it comes to our brains is that we just can't think about ourselves in the future. That is a big problem for us. And if perhaps in the past, in the jungle, we only had to think about a few years, even a few days. Now we have to think about decades.
Yes. So if you can't think about £900 in a year's time, how on earth are you going to think about £6,600 in when you retire? If you realise that you can't think like that, then what you need to do is something practical. So yes, I am sitting here drinking a cup of coffee from Pret. However,
there are other coffee shops available.
I should offer, in my defence, the fact that I am not one of those people who buys a cup of coffee every day. What I have is a cafetiere in the office and a pack of ground coffee so that we can all drink proper coffee in the office. Cafetiere sets you back 10, 15 quid. That'll last until Richard Browning drops it on the floor and smashes it. And then he'll buy a new one. He bought a metal one this time round to make sure that he didn't do that again. And a pack of coffee costs you £2.50. Mm-hmm. So the pack of coffee costs you the same as the coffee in Pret or Starbucks or Costa or Cafe Nero or whatever your coffee shop of choice is. But you can make how many cups of coffee from that pack of coffee? At least 20, I would imagine. And yes, it's not going to be quite the same as getting it from the coffee machine. But most people in this country basically order a bucket of milk anyway.
That's true.
So I don't know what they're complaining about. But that is a practical thing that you can actually do. But then how are you going to save the money that you're otherwise saving? Because if you just think, well, I'm saving £2.50 a day by not buying a coffee, what you're actually doing is leaving £2.50 a day in your bank account that you're probably going to spend on something else. So what you need to think about is, if I buy this cafetiere and I save my £2.50 a day, if I work 5 days a week, I'm saving myself £12.50 a week. And if I multiply that up by four, then I'm going to be saving £50 a month. So what I'm going to do at the start of every month is I'm going to take that £50 out when I get paid, and I'm going to put it somewhere, into a cash ISA. Maybe I'm going to put it into an investment account. Or maybe I'm going to put an extra £50 a month into my pension. And then you are actually saving that £50. And theoretically, if you forgo the £2.50 a day on a cup of coffee, then you're even. You're not taking an extra £50 out of your bank account that you wouldn't otherwise see. Mm. Obviously, you can factor into the first month the cost, the capital investment in buying the cafetiere. And should you so choose, you can set aside £2.50 less a week to pay for the pack of coffee that you buy. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it would be to sign up with one of these services where you can actually just quickly save the money that you would otherwise spend. Some of the banks do this. I think Nationwide's banking app does a little quick saver thing. You can save a small amount. Some of them do things like roundups. There's an investing service called Moneybox, Moneybox does roundups.
Yeah.
I don't think it yet does save small amounts of money. I bet there are some investing services out there that do it. But what you've got to do is make sure that every day you walk past that coffee shop and go and sit down at your desk, you hit the £2.50 button. Now, it's probably highly unlikely you're going to do that.
Moneybox, you can.
So do the £50 a month thing, like take it out at the start of the month. And so what this article's about, and what that extremely long explanation of saving money on coffee is about thinking about what you do and then trying to retrain your brain to make yourself a bit richer. And there is a prime example of how financial firms take advantage of us. Over the past 5 years or so, there's been a shift by banks towards overdrafts that they said they were simplifying the system.
Mm.
And these overdrafts will charge you £1 a day. Sounds pretty easy. I can understand £1 a day. However, in most cases, for most people, a £1 a day overdraft will be much, much more expensive than the traditional overdraft charging 18% annual interest. So if you go overdrawn before payday and you spend, you know, 5 to 7 days there, then you're going to be spending £5 to £7. Whereas if you did that by only a couple of hundred quid and you were being charged 18% interest a year, it would cost you much, much less than that. I can't do the maths in my head.
Yeah.
But that's a classic example of financial firms taking advantage of people. So just have a think about the things you do and then just slightly change your behaviour and you might get richer. Then you can afford coffee from Pret then.
I don't know. There's a part of me that just thinks that that's not quite answered the issue here. I just don't think we've answered how you can train your brain. I mean, some issues, like if you can think about yourself in the future with wrinkles, you know, that's supposed to help out. But you know what? I just think if someone was to save 50 quid and then you go back to your old, it's like a diet, isn't it? And if you fail on your diet and you go back to those coffees, you've got that 50 quid going out your bank. You're a bit short at the end of each month. What are you going to do? You're not going to stop your coffees. You're just going to stop that money going into a savings account.
True, but then you need to gamify it. You need to see how long you can keep saving that £50 for. If you can do it for 3 months and then you break for a month, you go, okay, well, I managed 3 months. Next time, can I manage 4 months? Turn it around on yourself. Play these games in your head so that you are effectively trying to encourage yourself into better behaviour. And we talked about this before with all the behavioural economics stuff, the nudge theory, the auto-enrolling people into pensions, and then they have to opt out. There's a classic example of rational and irrational thinking going on at the moment involving the Brexit negotiations, where we've desperately struggled to think about this thing rationally in the run-up to the referendum. Most people just went out and read a load of things that confirmed the things they already thought and then voted in the way they were going to vote anyway. Some got buyer's remorse and some then just stuck to their guns even more. But at the moment, we've got these negotiations going on with the EU, and you've got the hardline Brexiteers saying no deal is better than a bad deal. In fact, you've got some of the hardline Brexiteers just pushing for a no deal scenario anyway. Now, the argument there is we just trade on WTO rules, which means that we effectively just end up with this default position. That won't be that damaging to the economy because we can go out and strike all these buccaneering trade deals all over the place. But also there's other stuff that goes on there. For example, a no deal Brexit would mean that our airlines can no longer fly because they're governed through the European Aviation Safety Agency and things like that. It would cause a problem with our financial system and our banking system. Now, the argument being put forward by some of the hardline Brexiteers is that we don't need to worry about that because that won't happen, because that would be damaging, equally damaging to the EU as it would be to us, and the EU will behave rationally. Except, of course, we know that nobody in these negotiations or in this scenario is behaving rationally. In fact, there's an awful lot of irrational behaviour going on. And one of the reasons for voting ourselves out of the EU was because apparently the EU is so irrational. Yet we're saying that the EU will behave rationally. There is no reason to think that you could not find a scenario where the EU goes, you know what, if they really want to leave with no deal, let's properly punish them, and behaves irrationally, even though that will harm itself.
So I'm listening to a great book by Dan Ariely, behavioural economist, is talking about the pleasure that we get from revenge.
That is exactly what I'm talking about. Exactly what I'm talking about. And you're seeing this on both sides at the moment. This is not to be critical of the Brexiteers and praise the Remainers. I mean, the Remain side of the argument is equally as bad. The argument of like, well, we don't have to pay any attention to this referendum. It's not legally binding. That's completely irrational. Whilst basing its argument on something maintained to be rational, you cannot put a referendum to the country and then just go, we don't like the result, we're not going to do it. This whole thing is actually a case study in irrational behaviour.
Well, talking about things that we don't want to think about, Brexit was one of them. I'm sorry, Simon, you had to do it, didn't you? But the other one is imagining our future, which we've discussed. We're pretty bad at anyway. We have to think of such unpleasant things like we're going to die, how much our care costs are going to be. But while evidence suggests that practically we aren't really doing enough about it, we are certainly worrying a lot. Apparently, it's our top financial concern. But we're not telling anyone, even those closest to us, because according to some new research, we are a nation of silent money worriers. And I imagine, Lee, Christmas is a particularly troubling time for many. And what did this research particularly show? A nation of silent money worriers.
This is so British, isn't it? We just don't talk about our problems, really, particularly money. So this research from Seven Investment Management, 7 in 10 people admit keeping financial anxieties to themselves, which I think is a real shame, because at the end of the day, we've got partners and we've got family that may be able to help or may be able to give advice or perhaps have been in the same situation. And there was a report out this week as well about 2 million people are just constantly living in their overdraft. And there's real worries about credit card debt. We've spoken about this all year, and it feels like something is bubbling in terms of, you know, some sort of credit bubble. So first thing people should be doing is either confiding to close family members or getting in touch with a money charity. And there's plenty around that can really sort of help, you know, Step Change and places like that, where you can phone up and really just get it off your chest, because at the end of the day, you don't want to get into a vicious sort of debt cycle, which is what has been the worry in this country for a number of years, as it's steadily growing, as people buy more things on finance, as people get more credit cards. And it's a real worry, I think, Georgie, that people are clamming up about this. And even those that do confide in someone, so that's 3 in 10 people, 81% will talk to a spouse or partner, but quite often it ends up in an argument, which I think is just a real shame, isn't it? I mean, that's what, if you do have a partner, it should be, you should be able to lean on each other in times that are hard and hardship and things that are going on. And it shouldn't be a taboo subject, finances. You know, it affects us all if you're struggling. And this is such a British thing.
Well, you're right. It does affect us all. And what we've just been talking about in the previous segment was the fact that you're probably not alone with your worries. And actually, if you share them, they might not seem so big if you put it into some sort of context. But you spoke about some research this week. Mm. Last week, we got from the relationship support charity Relate, didn't we, that 1 in 7 of us is hiding debts from our partner. Mm-hmm. How, I wonder as well, being under stress, talking about our brains and evolution as well, makes us make bad decisions about money.
Exactly. Well, you could say that about all areas of your life. So if you're you know, anxious and you're not sleeping properly and these things sort of snowball out of control, and you start making irrational decisions and you might not be thinking clearly. And I know at the start of this program, we were talking about, you know, rewiring your brain and how complex financial problems we struggle to solve and struggle to get our heads around. But there's people out there to help you, and it's so easy to say, but to make those first steps to admit that you might have some sort of money problem, I think a little bit people feel a bit embarrassed, like it's not of their doing, like something's happened, you know, perhaps they've lost a job, or perhaps they're just finding it hard with the cost of living going up and wages sort of going nowhere. And people are just struggling to get by, and people are embarrassed to sort of put it on the line. But I don't think people should shoulder this burden alone. I really don't. It's a topic that's actually close to my heart, really, I think, because I've seen people all walks of life, and I think that some people are very open about their finances, are very happy to sort of tell you what's going on, or perhaps even that they are struggling a little bit. But the vast majority don't.
No, what you're talking about there is debt, but what this research is showing is that our top financial concern is our retirement planning. So it's our future. We are worrying about it, but all the evidence suggests, Simon, that we're not actually doing enough about it.
No.
Practically.
No, because I think that people struggle to realise how much money they need to save. And part of this research asked people how big a pension pot they would need to generate £10,000 a year income in retirement. And the average respondent's guess was £100,000, which basically broke down into men guessed on average 150,000, women guessed 75,000, and millennials, apparently they were split out. I think the millennials probably cover both men and women, just £60,000. I mean, this is hugely ambitious, because actually to get that £10,000 a year income in retirement, you effectively need to pretty much multiply that number by 20. If you're being ambitious, and you actually probably need to multiply it by 25. One of the things that Seven said is that actually, if people understood how much it would cost to buy the equivalent income of the state pension and how much that is worth, then they might understand a little bit more about how much it would cost to buy what they want on top of that. So the state pension works out at about £8,500 a year, and that would cost you £200,000. So right. If you want another £10,000, you're going to need about £250, basically, going on that maths. But then the problem is people think £250,000. Yeah. How on earth am I ever going to save £250,000? I'm having two coffees.
Exactly.
But compounding is the magical thing here, and putting money away from the earliest possible age, and understanding that if you put £50 into a pension, you will get tax relief on it. You'll get your 20% tax back, which gives you a 25% uplift on the money that you put in. And then also what you might find is that your employer matches that £50. So you put in 50, your employer puts in 50, you get the £12.50 tax relief, and all of a sudden you've got £112.50. So if someone walked up to you in the street and said, give me 50 quid and I give you £112.50, you'd say, that sounds like a pretty good deal, even though my brain is completely wired up wrong to think about these things.
And you're approaching me in the street offering me money. But
Yeah. So you do that, and then you put it into an investment vehicle, which is a pension, where you can't get that money until you're at least 55, and it's going to be 60 for anybody who's in their 20s, by the way. But the great advantage of that is, is that that means you can't spend your pension before you need it, and your pension is for your retirement years. And then you invest it every month, and it compounds up. Hopefully, you average 5% a year. And at the end of that period, if you start saving in your 20s, you're going to be a hell of a lot more likely to hit that £250,000 than you are if you just decide that you're going down the coffee shop. It's not even that. You get a letter that says you're being opted into a pension. Do you want to opt out? And you go, I'd rather have that 50 quid. Don't do that. But pay as much in as you can that your employer will match. Then the tax relief do the rest. And if you start doing it early enough, you'll find yourself that you're in a good position come your retirement years.
And we had a report, didn't we, from the OECD this week highlighting exactly what you've just said there, that we can't rely on the state pension in retirement. We're actually bottom of the retirement league. Lee, how did they work this out?
It looked at how it compares, Britain compares to the rest of the world. Well, it looked at all countries anyway, but how it came out bottom is the fact that a lot of people do just rely on the state pension. And if you do, it actually works out that you'll get 29% of how much you have earned at work through the years. So that's a big income drop if you're getting almost a quarter of what you were used to getting before on a monthly basis. So the report broke it down into that, and also private pensions. So once you actually club in private pensions and people that actually do have a private pension and pay into it, we sort of go up the league a little bit further, which is encouraging, but it's not very good news for those people that haven't saved into a private pension. And it actually, what it really highlights is how much you probably need to be looking at a private pension. And actually, one of my regrets is that I didn't sort out my private pension earlier. I sort of looked at it in my early 20s and went, oh, pension. And then, you know, I wish I started a couple of years earlier, because it is incredible what the magic of compounding can do, and, you know, match contributions and all that sort of thing. And it's actually, as I've got into sort of my 30s now, but in a lot of people in their late 20s do ask me, what do I do with my pension, or what do I need to be doing to save for retirement? Because I think it's becoming more of an issue as we see stories about the rising costs of care. Expensive now, what's it going to be like, you know, when we get to retirement age, you know, people even in the 40s and 50s? And also, we're just living longer. So a lot of people now, you know, that are born now probably live till they're 100. You know, and if the retirement age is 70, that's quite a big old, you know, retirement to prepare for. So to rely solely on a state pension, if it still exists in, you know, 30, 40 years, is probably not a very good tactic. But yeah, there's lots of little nuggets of information in that OECD report. And it actually, it's a very interesting thing to read about. And it's got me thinking about how different pension systems work across the world. Some countries have a combination of both mandatory and voluntary payments that then fund your retirement. Holland and Denmark, for example, they have the highest rates of retirement cash. But it's all relative to the person, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say. For example, I have a relative that recently hit state pension in the summer. They don't have a private pension, which is a worry. And you think, oh, you know, how are you going to get by? But on the flip side, they own a property outright, so they don't really have any outgoings. So this relative...
But they can't spend the property, can they?
They can't spend the property. You know, an asset rich. And that's what I think a lot... There's probably quite a lot of people in a similar scenario, but their relative is saying, well, I've got my property, so I have no mortgage payments. My bills are less than my state pension, I'm better off than when I was working. So you will get a few sort of, you know, things that skew the system like that, if you see what I mean. So some people actually maybe can, but I would say definitely now, my strongest piece of advice, if you're first starting out work and you think you can't afford to put even 1% away for your pension, I would do it.
So just to go back to what I was saying about the maths, if you can get £200 a month into your pension, which you can include your contributions, your employer's contributions and the tax relief, it will take you 37 years and 1 month if you get a 5% return to have £250,000. Now, you have to bear in mind that £250,000 in 37 years will not buy you what £250,000 buys today. However, you're also likely to see your earnings go up over that period of time. So as your earnings go up, you save more every month. But if we just worked on the basis of everything being equal, 37 years sounds like an awfully long time. However, if you are 25... then that's pretty much when you're going to be retiring. If you're lucky, you'll probably be retiring later. So actually, it is a working career. And that is not an unachievable aim for people if they start early enough.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Now to something else. Some more good news for savers from NS&I this time. You can now get your hands on not one, but four new accounts, two guaranteed growth bonds and a pair of guaranteed income bonds paying slightly lower rates, but they offer the chance to have interest paid monthly. Now, there is a catch, though. Lee, what is the catch to these?
The catch to these is that they can only be opened online, which is a real shame, actually, because a lot of older savers obviously aren't online. You know, they don't have the internet or don't
why
feel comfortable.
This?
I'm not actually 100% sure why NSI logic is that you can only open it online. I can only guess is that they... Remember a couple of years ago when they launched the pensioner bonds for over 65s and the phone lines got jammed and it was just absolute chaos as people tried to pile in as much money as they possibly could into these sort of bumper deals. I wonder if they're trying to manage it more by saying actually encouraging people to go online. But I will find out the definitive answer and see actually if there are exceptional circumstances in which people can open them on the phone, because actually once you've opened it online you can then manage it on the phone, you can manage it by post. So I don't quite know the full logic behind making it an online only product. But what I will say about these NS&I bonds is actually a second bit of good news from NS&I, the government backed provider, because we had the changes in premium bonds this month, so the odds have gotten better and there's more prizes and the underlying rates gotten better. And this is actually the first time that we've had a product like this from NS&I in 8 years, which is a little flickering light of encouragement for savings. Maybe we have hit the bottom at
Whisper
the start
softly.
Of this year and we're starting to see a little bit of movement going upwards here. This is a good sign. I think... in my heart of hearts, though, what has actually happened is, do you remember in last year's budget when Philip Hammond launched a 2.2% 3-year bond, but you could only put a maximum of $3,000 in? Mm-hmm. Now, that account has been somewhat of a damp squib, I would imagine. Now, when we had the pensioner bonds, we got daily updates from a grinning George Osborne saying how this has been the most successful financial product in British history, you know, and how happy he was with all this money going in, et cetera, et cetera. This time around, I've asked a number of times the Treasury and S&I how much money has gone into that bond, and I've not been given an answer. So that probably shows you that it hasn't been that well received. A number of our readers are going, up to $3,000? Ooh. You know, this is no good. It doesn't beat inflation. But these accounts that they brought out, they have a 1.5% rate over a year and a 2.2% over 3 years. So it's the same rate, but you could put up to £1 million in. And you may go, oh, God, you know, but some people do want to have a safe haven like that. And they want a government-backed provider. And they don't want to have to faff around with getting £85,000 in different savings accounts. You know, it's a great problem to have, but to have the FSCS protection. Now, the other good thing about this NS&I product is that they have a monthly income option. I can't stress enough how much there's been a lack of products that offer monthly income, which are very popular with pensioners because they might have a lump sum that they just want a regular bit of money coming each month. Okay, the rate isn't going to blow your mind at 2.2%, but compared to what has been happening and what we have had in recent sort of months and years, it's an encouraging step. So we may start to see things trickle up. The NS&I have some net financing target every financial year. So how much money they expect to come in minus what goes out, and there's the target. They've actually reduced the target for this financial year, probably because they expected more money to come in from the bonds we mentioned from the budget. But they still need to meet that target, and I don't know how short they are of it, but I think launching a product like this and boosting the rates on something like premium bonds, which I tip my hat for, you know, them passing on the 0.25% base rate rise from last month when a lot of big banks haven't. And let's hope that this is the start of some better deals coming out.
Well, it's interesting. I got an email from my bank this morning, which said, we are increasing the rate, etc., of some of our most popular savings products. Obviously, they didn't tell me how much by, but there were some stonking ones of 0.45, 0.75. Oh, it's absolutely blown away.
Well, we had some research this week where a lot of building societies and challenger banks have passed on the full 0.25%. Some have been, the big banks have finally sort of come out and said, oh, we're raising rates, but some have raising rates by like 0.05%. You know, just being stingy with it. people are fed up. I'm having so many conversations with people, especially older people at the moment, are just kind of fed up with savings and fed up with my ISA. I'm closing my ISA. I'm investing. I'm doing this, that, and the other. And I wouldn't be surprised if we do start seeing some upward movement in savings rates for the fact that people are just taking money out of accounts. Yeah. And if you vote with your feet, these banks, you know, start going, well, actually, because let's face it, the big banks still have a monopoly on savings cash. You know, people still have money that they've just, for whatever reason, they've left languishing at silly rates. And the change starts from a saver. They have to start moving the money across. And we had a couple of weeks ago, the deputy of the Bank of England saying, you know, these rates are criminal, but we can't force banks to increase rates. You need to move your money. You need to sort of chase other rates. And then hopefully banks will start having to put their rates up.
Well, from saving to investing, Lee, you did mention it, as the world is going Bitcoin crazy. We continue to see record highs in established stock markets. It is party time for investors. But what happens when music stops or they put on a really bad record? So do you have a plan B? What's a plan B, Simon? What's all this about?
Well, it always pays to think about what might happen and not to work on the basis that what's happening right now will be what happens forever and a day, particularly when that involves you making money by investing. Because as a general rule, what goes up will eventually come down at some point. Not necessarily all the way down, but normally down quite a bit. We haven't had a major correction in the stock market, by which I mean the stock market falling 10%, so not a crash, in a good year and a half at least, possibly slightly longer. Now, you would expect some kind of pullback of that magnitude at least once a year. So that's unusual. If you look at the stock market that leads the world, the US is expensive in terms of share prices at the moment. It's not at the max, but the max was achieved at the height of the dot-com boom, which was a mania. And in fact, it's only been more expensive at the height of the dot-com boom and the 1920s, both of which were bubbles. So you need to be aware that there is the possibility that markets are going to take a tumble. And the worst thing that you can do if markets do take a tumble is panic. Sell all your holdings, which is a classic piece of going back to what we were talking about.
What our brains want to
do. Our brains are wired up completely wrong. There are a million and one investing surveys and reports that illustrate that investors manage to underperform the companies that they invest in, the stock market indexes that are made up of those companies, the funds that they buy, because they basically buy high and they sell low. And even people with only the vaguest grasp of investing will know that actually that's the opposite of what you're meant to do. So what you need to do is think about that and think ahead. So you could have a plan B that you put into action when the market is falling and it's down 5%, down 10%. But by that point, it's probably a little bit late. So what you want to do is try and build a plan B into your investing strategy, i.e. if things do go wrong, what will happen to my portfolio? How exposed am I? So Warren Buffett, world's most famous investor, his first rule of investing is not to lose money. Right, that's something that is particularly difficult to achieve. And it's even harder to achieve if you don't happen to be a billionaire like Warren Buffett. So the second best tactic is to protect yourself as much as possible. So whilst you can decide that you're doing stonkingly well from share prices going up, which actually the UK market hasn't been doing amazing, but most UK investors will be invested around the world in different places, you need to realise that at some point it is going to fall. So what can you do? Well, you need to think about the things that will protect you. Firstly, diversification. Are you invested into a nice wide variety of things, meaning if it's shares that you're invested in, a wide variety of companies, of markets, if you're buying funds and investment trusts or ETFs, that you're not overly concentrated just in one market, for example, the UK, but also different assets, for example, bonds. And also you need to think about cash here. Cash is an asset, and cash is the asset that will provide you with a great deal of protection, because your cash in the bank is protected if you keep it below the FSCS savings limit. And if the stock market falls, you'll still have that cash in the bank. And actually, you can then use it to go and buy some shares on the cheap. So you need to make sure that you're diversified. The other thing that you need to do is to think about what is your tolerance to risk. And anybody listening to that will just feel the shutters coming down over their eyes. In normal people's language, if you open your ISA one day, how much could you see the money that you have in there down by before you really freaked out and hit the panic button? What you need to then do is think about, am I so biased towards one thing in here that that thing is actually quite volatile and it could fall by that amount? So to use an example that's in the media at the moment, Bitcoin. Say you've decided to invest in Bitcoin and you've put half your money in Bitcoin. Extreme, but I bet there are people out there who've put half their money in Bitcoin at the moment. Bitcoin, the other day, managed to fall 20% in one day. It was not unusual. Bitcoin is hugely volatile. So if you put half of your money into Bitcoin and then the next day Bitcoin had fallen 20%, how are you going to feel? Are you going to panic and sell out at that level and think, oh, it's going to keep going lower, it's going to keep going lower, I need to get out? I mean, you might be right, it might keep going lower. But that kind of reaction is really bad for you. So then the other thing to think about is, when are you going to trigger your plan B? So triggering your plan B, as I said before, when things are already bad, is not a good idea. Putting it into place before things are bad is a good idea. And then finally, Ben Kumar, Seven Investment Management, gave the good piece of advice that a solid plan A is a good plan B. So if you just make sure that your plan A stands up to scrutiny, i.e. it isn't just catering for when things are going well for you, it's catering for when things are going bad as well, and you're sufficiently diversified, then you probably don't need an emergency plan, because your emergency plan is built into your original plan in the first place.
Well explained. Thank you very much. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce, that was your plan B, or was it really your plan A masquerading as a plan B, or the other way around? But either way, to help train your brain to make the right financial choices, just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes and tell your friends and family? It all helps.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings, backed by HM Treasury.